using bootstrappers too. They have three main revenue streams. They sell about 50 puppies a year at $3,500 each, have the dog training program that allows them to house six dogs at a time, charging $2,500 per dog each session, and they smoke cheese. Cheese, I tell you. But in addition to their primary revenue focus, they also write best-selling books and have retreats on the property. And it doesn't end there. They have a marketing department, they're on social media, and they have a lovely gift shop that keeps the register ringing. Of course, they also have expenses to look after, like the cook, the maintenance man, and everyday living. But they definitely make enough money to keep the lights on. They're in the black. It's a super efficient operation, and young entrepreneurs could learn a lot from their infrastructure. They each have ownership of their own division, but know the roles of the others in case they have to fill in. It works like this. One monk is in charge of each vertical. Brother Gregory, the guests, activities, and the gift shop. Brother Mark, kitchen and services. Brother Thomas, dog training program. Brother Luke, Brother John, dog breeding. Brother Ambrose, cheese. Brother Stavros, the church. Brother Christopher oversees the whole thing. One team, one dream. And what I love most is that they are completely self-taught. They learned all of this on the fly. No experience necessary. I always say experience is overrated. It takes too long. Start the process and figure the rest out. If you wait too long, someone else will beat you to the punch, or that bully in your head will talk you out of pursuing your idea. I was excited by everything I learned, so excited that I sat down with Brother Christopher to talk strategy. I had a list of ideas I thought could be moneymakers for the monastery. You guys are the experts, I said. Brother Christopher smiled. I think you have an opportunity. Since you're an authority in your industry, you can leverage that credibility and expand well beyond breeding and training. The obvious extension would be to sell leashes, collars, and dog toys, but that income is not recurring. Let's set up a line of dog food and vitamins for everyone who buys a puppy. If each dog lives on average for 10 plus years and we get them on a monthly food plan, it will add up. I quickly took out a pen and did the math for Brother Christopher. 50 puppies a year, multiplied by 12 months of food, multiplied by 10 years, etc. It becomes quite lucrative and it never stops. This would be a great way to add an additional revenue stream for the life of each dog. Plus, I already have the name. Man's Blessed Friend. He liked that. But I knew he needed more convincing, so I told him this story. Recently, my friend in Atlanta asked me to meet with the founder of a company called No Foods. He told me they make a line of grain-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, everything-free breads, pastas, waffles, and cookies that he said were delicious. He told me they were raising money and thought it'd be a fit for me given my lifestyle. I explained that I really don't invest in anything outside of my own projects, but after listening to my friend's hard pitch, I agreed to a meeting only, no strings. At this stage of my life, I have a very simple formula. I want low aggravation and high reward. If something has a super high return but comes with a lot of aggravation, I'm not interested. That goes for investments, friends, travel, everything. So I agreed to meet under the condition this potential investment will come with little to no aggravation. He agreed. The founder, Steve Hanley, showed up with a bread box filled with products. Since my son eats gluten-free, I tried almost every gluten-free product on the market. When I bit into the sliced bread with an avocado on top, the whole notion of aggravation went away. I wanted in. The more I learned about the product, the more I liked it. It had very few ingredients, which made it way easier on your digestion. I knew all the ingredients, and it was tasty and nutritiously superior to anything I'd seen on the market. The one potential knock was there were no preservatives in the foods, which would greatly impact the shelf life of the products. This product could go bad quickly. While everyone thought that was a big negative, I thought it was actually a big positive. God didn't make food to sit on a shelf in a plastic package for 2 years, I told Steve. This message may actually resonate with our customers. After our second meeting, I was so impressed, I moved Steve's entire team into Spanx's office. They took over the second floor and used the kitchen as their new products lab. After some diligence, it was now time to decide on the investment. I put Steve in touch with my team of advisors. I was certain they would love this opportunity. One of the best things I did when I could afford it was hire experts. Some of those experts sit on a small investment committee that oversees all of the deals Sarah and I make. That is a serious upgrade from my old investment team. Me. Steve, send all the info to my team to evaluate, I said. A day or two later, I get a call from my lead dog. Jesse, I have a recommendation on the no foods investment, he said. Great. How much do you think we should put in the deal? Actually? Nothing. I think you're nuts to invest in this. Wait, what? The CEO has no experience in the food business, none. He also has zero marketing background. I mean, he's never done anything like this. How's he going to get all the manufacturing and sales off the ground? He had a point, but then I asked this question. Have you ever actually met Steve?
No.
Have you seen the fire in his eyes? No. Have you seen his passion for making this work? No. Wire him the money. Again, you are the business plan. If I would have told someone in my 20s I was going to start a private jet company with no money, no experience in aviation, no rich friends, and no airplanes, they'd have laughed me out of the room. If you marry your dreams with drive, urgency, passion, and a burning desire to finish what you start, you can do anything. I summarized my idea to Brother Christopher in two sentences. There's reoccurring revenue for you guys while also being able to improve the dogs' lives. If you find supplements that you truly believe in, they can help the dog's health. It's a win-win. Let's keep the lines of communication open on this, Brother Christopher said. While I was speaking with Brother Christopher, I felt pumped up, animated, and alive. It's like my words and actions were coming from another place, a pure place. These are cues I look for in myself when talking business and or ideas with other people. Just as I was clearly able to see it in Steve Hanley's eyes, I could feel it inside of me when talking with Brother Christopher. That tells me, regardless of what I do in the future, I should stay connected to my passion. 6 p.m. Sundays are help yourself to supper nights, which is another way of saying leftovers. Brother Christopher made pasta and left a note that read, up for grabs. I grabbed. After dinner, I watched the news with the brothers. We all huddled around the small television the monks have in the reading room. It is for Sunday evening news updates. Mostly, I watch the monks, watch the news. And like all great bullies, Billy came out of nowhere. I started working up the courage to announce my plans for a departure. It sort of felt like getting psyched up to ask a girl out back in junior high. I wanted to ask her, but I didn't have the courage to say it, not out loud. Actually, it was probably more like working up the courage to break up with the girlfriend. But then the monks were smiling and laughing, making me feel part of the group. It was nice. And during TV time, the monks invited me to go on a hike with a few of them tomorrow. It felt good to be included, and I was excited to get off the monastery. But it squashed my plans of letting them know I was thinking about leaving. After the invite to hike, I couldn't tell them. Still, I'm going to book a return trip to Atlanta soon. Day 8. Off campus. In this day and age, We are dangerously out of touch with the non-human world around us, leaving our ears dulled and our vision blurred. The monks of Nuski. It's hiking day and we're going off the property. Getting off the monastery has me fired up. We're leaving soon. I was just in the dining room and a couple of the brothers were getting their packs ready. Everyone was fired up. Fired up in a monk way. Smiles and shit, but you could feel the energy. We'll leave in 10 minutes, Stavros said. Be ready. Roger that. He asked if I'd like to hike. I told him about Mount Washington and how inspirational of a climb it was. He must have seen the excitement in my eyes because he started getting excited too. He told me they hike every Monday and how some of their hikes have been extremely grueling. This guy is 70 plus years old. There are people half his age who think walking to the fridge is grueling. He must have some crazy monk hiking strength. This is going to be great. 15 minutes later. I walked up to the parking area, but there was only one small car in the lot. Brother Stavros was already waiting and told me to hop in the back. And then he said that Lenny the intern, Brother Mark, Brother Thomas, and Brother Thomas's dog would be there shortly. He was kidding, right? 5 adults and a huge dog in this tiny car? He wasn't kidding. As I turned around, I saw them coming up the hill. It seemed like I was the only one concerned about the amount of room in the car. We piled in. Brother Mark popped the trunk and yelled, "Up in the trunk!" And his dog jumped right in and laid down. Brother Mark took the front seat. Lenny sat next to me in the back, and then Brother Thomas came around and in through Lenny's side. It forced Lenny into the middle. We used to call that riding bitch growing up. But I was pretty sure no one would find anything humorous or entertaining with me sharing that tidbit. Lenny squished in between us in a weird yoga position. The car was worse than Turney's. Dog hair everywhere. Old maps on the floor, mud all over the seats. The car looked like it hadn't been washed in years, because it hadn't been washed in years. With 5 grown men in the car, it didn't smell that great either. Whatever, man, I thought. We're going hiking. Brother Stavros took off like someone just waved the green and yellow flag at the Daytona 500. Go! He flew down the driveway and accelerated into the first right turn. Maybe monks have some type of force field that keeps them from getting hurt in accidents. Last I looked, I didn't have one. But honestly, I didn't care. I was dying to get off of the monastery grounds and see some of the real world. For the last 7 days, I've only been able to walk to the mobile homes and turn around. And right on cue, the 2 wild dogs went bonkers as we whizzed past the mobile homes. 20 yards later, we hit the main road and the barks faded from earshot. Stavros wasn't slowing down. He went from Daytona to Le Mans down the mountainous curves. I'm exaggerating, but each time he'd take the curve in the road, Lenny the intern, in a downward pretzel position, would slam into Brother Thomas or me. But the only thing that mattered was we were going for a hike. And there's no way God would let a car full of monks with an intern and me get into a car crash, right? When we hit the straightaway, sort of a country route, I started absorbing the surroundings. I wanted to soak them all in. And everything was a landmark for me in case I'm able to someday run off of the property. Stavros kept flying down the narrow road. We passed through a town that had a gas station, a school, and a Rite Aid. And then Brother Thomas told me we were going to stop at the Rite Aid on the way home because Lenny needed eardrops. Eardrops? Poor guy's been just about stone deaf for a week, he said. Wait, he's been deaf? Lenny, the intern, is deaf? That's what's wrong with him? He's not a serial killer? He just can't hear? Holy crap! I felt bad for a moment. I'd misjudged him. But then I wondered, why eardrops were the solution? The guy can't hear and they want to get him eardrops? How about a hospital? How about before the hike? This is insanity. 5 more minutes, Brother Stavros said at a red light. Are you ready, Jesse?
Yes, sir.
We finally arrived at our destination. It was called Baton Kill River. Our guide greeted us as we arrived. His name was Bo, and I learned that Bo hikes with the monks every week. He has to be 80 years old and looks like he could be a love interest of one of the Golden Girls. But I have to give it to him. He was prepared. Bo pulled out a backpack that would put Dora the Explorer to shame. He had duct tape, purification pills, a first aid kit, a compass, and flares. Where were we going that we would need purification pills or flares? Oh boy, this is going to be intense, I thought. After we all gathered around, Bo pulled out a map to show us where we'd be hiking today. I got tiny butterflies floating around my stomach as the map unfolded. It was almost go time. And then finally he pointed at the 2.5-mile paved road on the map.
When we get to the top of the road, we'll eat here, he said. Turn around and come home.
Wait, what? We're hiking up a paved road? I didn't say that out loud, but I was thinking it. Why did he have all of these safety stuff if we're going up and down a road? It was impossible to get lost on a paved road.
What's next? Climb up an escalator?
After the initial surprise, I got over it. Enjoy the process, I told myself. It was fairly warm out, so I packed light. I figured we'd sweat going up the mountain. Hill? I knew from my Mount Washington experience the importance of layering up, but I didn't think that was necessary today. We started heading up, which I figured would take a total of 2 hours, but about 10 minutes in, I realized at the pace we were going, we'd be out here for 5 hours. Meanwhile, Lenny the intern took off like it was a race. It was like he's mad that I got so much attention about Mount Washington, and he had something to prove. I thought about going after him and leaving the monks, but I couldn't do that. Stav and Bo were super slow, so I rolled up with Brother Thomas, Brother Mark, and his dog. About 5 minutes up the hill, Brother Mark came to a stop, turned to me and said,
"Go ahead a bit and please, don't look back. I have to yellow the snow here."
This gave me an opportunity for some one-on-one time with Brother Thomas. Of course, I've seen him every day since training the dogs with him, but this was a great opportunity to really get to know him. He's 33 and the youngest of the monks. I was really curious about what he misses most. He said the freedom of saying, "Hey, I want to get Chinese food tonight." I totally get that. I miss that too. One thing I'm struggling with is the idea of freedom. I do have freedom, but I don't really have freedom of choice up here. Many of the things I have access to at home, I don't have here. A stock fridge, a car, a microwave, and bicycle. While part of me likes this simplicity, I'm also missing many comforts from home that I take for granted. I couldn't do this full time. Like all the monks, Brother Thomas pledged all of his belongings to the monastery when he came. His only possession is a driver's license. Makes me wonder, if I'm a cop and pull a monk over for speeding, would I give him a ticket? Brother Thomas's car and everything he owned was turned over to the monastery. Now if he wants something, he goes to petty cash, or for bigger purchases, it goes to committee to decide if it's necessary and approved. One of the vows all the monks take is poverty, meaning the non-attachment to things, just within their means. Sounds similar to Seal. He perfected the minimalist lifestyle. After he stayed with me, it inspired me to clean out my garage and closets to get down to 30 items. Liberating. Not a single day has gone by where I said, "Wow, I really wish I had a second bicycle pump." It decluttered my mind too. It freed up energy. It's like I didn't have to spend any thought on what I was going to wear that day. I just put on what was hanging in the closet. I think the monks have all of those same freedoms. We kept climbing the hill. The monks must take four vows. Number one, poverty, the non-attachment to things, just within your means. Number two, chastity. People are expected to have matured within their sexuality. I asked Brother Stavros if he felt deprived of sex. He said he's not deprived because he chose this life. Number three, obedience. You agree to cooperate with the order of the community. It's about respect to the moment you're in, responsibility for one another. Some communities have an abbot where the buck stops. Newskeet doesn't any longer. They have a prior, Brother Christopher, who's been voted into term. But everyone has input and it's more by consensus or majority. Number four, stability. That you stay in one place. That's why the cemetery is right there. Does everyone get along? I asked. I'm going to live with Thomas, Stavros said behind me. I'm committed to him and the others. Because of that commitment, why wouldn't I want to be at peace with him? Every Friday at 7:15 p.m., the monks have sharing. You have 5 minutes to discuss anything that's on your mind with the others and what may have happened during the week. It's also a time to clear things up if you're pissed at someone. And at the end of the 5 minutes, there's a chance for the other monks to respond. That seems like a really great system to me. I made a mental note to mention this to Sarah when I get home. We can both relate because being an entrepreneur is lonely. If something breaks, you have to deal with it. But up here, it's a community. If the toilet is clogged, they share that responsibility 8 ways. Do guys ever quit? I ask. Just say, enough is enough? One brother left and married a girl in town, and others have left too. But it's rare, he said. To become a monk, the process can take 2 to 3 years. First, you're a seeker, and then you have a 6 to 12 month candidacy when you live at the monastery. And then, psychological evaluations and references are done. Then, the candidates ask to come in as a novice. If they're received, they get a new name, and then, monastic profession. Full step of commitment to the vows. So what about the hair? Cutting off the hair goes back to Roman days. If you were in someone's service, you would shave your head. That way, if you ran away, they looked for the bald guy. Now, it's a token of rendering service to monastic life. That made sense. We kept heading up the hill. Why aren't any of the drawings on the wall in the church of blacks? There is, Stavros said. Moses the Black from Skeet, Egyptian. And there's a trend to not represent people totally accurately, but to use depictions. That's why most have the same olive skin. At this point, Lenny the intern was a mile ahead of us. Since Lenny couldn't hear, I realized there was no way to call for him. Brother Mark, Brother Thomas, and I got to the top of the mountain hill first and looked everywhere. We waited for Bo and Brother Stavros, and a few minutes later, they made it up. The road flattened out at the top of the hill, and it looked like a perfect place for local high school kids to drink a few stolen six-packs of beer.
Where's Lenny? This is against protocol, Bo said. No hiker can hike alone out here. It's not safe.
He pulled out a whistle from his jacket, blew it, and then started yelling,
Lenny!
Bo, Lenny is deaf, I said. I told the group I'd go on a one-man search and recovery mission to find Lenny. I went off the road and about a mile down the steep, snowy mountain. And then I finally saw Lenny about a quarter mile ahead. I double-stepped my way and caught him in about 5 minutes. Yo, I said, we gotta stick together. Lenny just looked at me, so I used my finger to point up. Let's go! Once we were all back together, we had a quick lunch. It was really nice to be out and away from the monastery. After we finished, we headed back down. There was a lot less talking on the way down, but it was comfortable. We all just enjoyed the nature. When we got to the bottom, I offered to ride home with Bo. I liked my chances of survival better with him. But on top of being old and cautious,
Beau drove like he was in England, on the wrong side of the road. It might have been safer in Stavros' car.
We stopped at Rite Aid for Lenny's ear medicine, and I have to say, I never realized how much fun a Rite Aid could be. I felt like Charlie in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. This was the first civilization I've seen in months. Okay, days, but it felt like months. There were real humans at Rite Aid, and they were walking around like they had lives to lead. There were newspapers, candy, good soaps, products. I didn't know what to do with myself. It was all so glorious. They have aspirin, I said to no one, and Band-Aids. I saw an older woman look over at me. I think she thought I was mental because she kept a safe distance between us. I didn't care. I grabbed the Method foam soap pump and said to her, I love this soap. That's when she ducked into another aisle. I didn't want to leave. I bought a newspaper and chocolate. Seriously, it was like being at Disney World for the first time. And I didn't care how long the lines were. I could have stayed there for hours. I guess this is a great example of how much we take for granted. I mean, seriously, I never thought I'd be grateful for a Rite Aid. Normally, I'd try to avoid going there. It's like some of these chain pharmacy stores actually train their employees to go slowly and make customers wait. Today, though, I loved it. I want to go back. On the drive home to the monastery, I held on to my plastic bag like a 9-year-old holding on to his bag of Halloween candy. It was mine. It was all mine. I wasn't going to let go. I was grateful for soap. But why don't I feel like that every time I leave a pharmacy? 8 p.m. So, the diagnosis is back, and Lenny can hear. The eardrops didn't work, so the monks took Lenny to a clinic. Brother Stavros told me they drained about a gallon of wax out of each of Lenny's ears. How can you let a gallon of wax accumulate in your ears? Didn't he ever hear of a Q-tip? A washcloth? After he got back, I saw him in the reading room and had my first real conversation. Where'd you go to school, Lenny?
UNLV.
Cool. Well, what'd you study?
Books.
Do you like this place versus the Indian reservation?
Hard to say.
Okay. Well, what do you plan next?
Undetermined.
Are you staying here long?
Undetermined.
Lenny's lips didn't move when he spoke. Maybe he studied ventriloquism. Are you happy up here?
Is that a trick question? Joy is fleeting, he said. Or should I say, happiness is fleeting?
Huh? Silence. It wasn't going well. Maybe I should ask it like this, I said. What are you looking for, Lenny? For the first time, he stopped looking at my head and stared at me with his dark eyes. He didn't say a word. Religion? Direction? I asked, trying to help him along. Or are you not sure and you'll just know when you know?
I'm looking for all of the above.
And then he went back to his computer and pretended I wasn't there. I think I like Lenny better when he couldn't hear. Or do I have some deep-seated desire for Lenny to like me? That's an underlying theme in my life. I want to be liked. Is that an insecurity or an asset? Day 9. Broken or breakthrough? Breakthroughs happen when limiting thoughts and behaviors are challenged. Fabian Fredrickson. I woke up this morning feeling sluggish. It wasn't unrest, it was more like restlessness. Perhaps it's the expectations I had coming in. Expectations are tricky and often set us up for disappointment. I wasn't motivated to go see the sunrise. I don't know why. And as I lay in bed staring at the ceiling, I kept thinking about Sarah. She'd said something before I left that seemed rather profound, but now I wasn't so sure. Two nights before I left for the monastery, I was out to dinner with Sarah, and we were chatting about the different things I might be doing up at the monastery. There was a lot of excitement and anticipation of the unknown. Neither of us had a clue about what living with monks would look like. And then I asked Sarah how long I should stay. Stay until you have a breakthrough, or you're broken, she said. It sounded like great advice, and I consider her an expert on this topic. She told me the first time she remembers being on the edge of a breakthrough or being broken. It was when she was 15 years old and saw her friend get struck by a car and killed. Her friend was riding her bike on a bridge in Florida when it played out before her very eyes. It obviously was a traumatic experience for her, and at the time, she had no idea a breakthrough was even possible. Around the same time, her parents were getting a divorce. She says that nearly broke her for good. But when her dad was leaving the house for the last time, he handed her a series of Wayne Dyer motivational cassettes. And this was her breakthrough. Sarah started listening to the tapes every day. It helped her deal with the tragedy of her friend and the difficulty of her parents splitting up. Sarah listened to the self-help tapes constantly, over and over again. She couldn't get enough. She listened to them so much that her friends in high school started refusing to get into her car because they couldn't take listening to them anymore. She credits Wayne Dyer CDs and the inner work she did as a big part of her success. The gap between breakthroughs and being broken is so narrow that sometimes it's impossible to see. What I'm dealing with now is nothing close to what Sarah went through, but it's a different kind of mindfuck. Sarah was dealing with real shit. When I put it in that kind of perspective, it makes it easier. That is, until I wait 5 minutes and get all up in my head again. Perspective is such a beautiful thing, but the key is to never let it go when you're holding on to it. My grip on perspective isn't as tight as it should be. I'm not sure if I'm closer to a breakthrough or being broken. It feels like neither. This afternoon, I walked 4 miles up and down the road. I've been able to stay consistent in getting in around 10 miles a day. Usually I do 3 miles between breakfast and chores and do the rest in the afternoon after dinner. While my phone doesn't get a signal, it still is a function that accurately counts my mileage, so I've been bringing it on my walks. I stayed to the far right of the road because some of the snow melted last night, making the path rather muddy. And I was just walking like normal when I heard a ding on my phone, and I felt the vibration. When I looked at it, I noticed 2 texts had found their way onto my phone, and I had 1 bar of service. 1 bar! I moved from the spot I was standing, and the bar went away. Wow. There's 1 spot on this isolated 500-acre property that gets cell service? And I just found it? I immediately went back to it, and the 1 bar reappeared. I started typing a text to my wife. Me. I love you. I miss you. I miss the kids. Don't forget the kids have soccer today. As soon as I hit send, I saw the 3 little bubbles forming, indicating that Sarah was texting me back. I was so excited. I literally felt like the professor just fixed the transistor radio on Gilligan's Island. I couldn't wait for her to text back. Sarah, sweetie, today is Tuesday, not Sunday. Are you okay? Me, no, it's Sunday. Are you okay? Sarah. I'm okay, but I'm looking at a calendar. Are you sure you're okay? Really? It's Tuesday? I started counting on my fingers and she was right. I'm in the land that time forgot. Time exists only on clocks and calendars. It has no worth at the monastery. Me. How was soccer on Sunday? Sarah. Funny you should ask. I actually thought it was Saturday. On Sunday. Me. So, no soccer? Sarah. Sorry, no soccer. What have you been doing? Me. Washing dishes,
scrubbing floors, and training dogs.
Sarah,
what?
How are you holding up?
Me.
The monks have been great. Nuns, too.
Also, I met a spiritual intern who I thought was trying to kill me, but it turned out he had a gallon of wax in his ears.
Sarah, nuns?
Me.
Cool nuns.
Sarah,
are there any other kind?
Tell me, did you bring enough clothing?
Me.
Too much. I've worn the same thing every day.
Sarah.
What? I'm not surprised.
Me.
I haven't even showered yet.
How are the kids?
Sarah.
They miss you a ton, but they're all doing well.
Question. Do you want to come to LA this weekend with Laser and me? I'm taking him to Disney.
I think it's enough already up there, love.
Me.
Disney?
That's unbelievable. Of course I want to go.
But I don't know.
Sarah.
We miss you, but we want you to do what's in your heart.
Me.
Let me see what I can do. Maybe I'll just come home tomorrow.
Sarah.
Okay, honey. Just let us know.
Me.
Love you.
Sarah.
Love you too.
And then I saw the bubble on my screen. She was still typing.
Sarah.
If you are coming home, please take a shower. Winky face.
So today is Tuesday. I'm not any closer to a breakthrough, but it felt good to text with Sarah. She put a smile on my face. I have friends who travel all of the time who tell me it makes their marriage stronger. It's because they spend time away from each other and really appreciate the time they do have. That makes sense to me. But right now, I really wish I was home. I've missed them enough. So, I took Sarah's advice and took my first shower. I hadn't really felt the need until now because you just get re-dirty the next day. But the dirt was sticking to me. I was gross. The shower was super small and the shower head in my bathroom was installed for someone the size of an 8-year-old. I felt like one of those yoga masters who can fit inside of a suitcase. There was an old plastic chair in the shower, so I sat on it to get low enough to let the water fall on me. Man, did it feel good. But I still can't kick it. I'm homesick. I miss my wife, my kids. I'm ready to leave. But is that the bully talking or the truth? I'm going home tomorrow. Day 10. Honest moments. The first big pitfall is to let society define what happiness is. Brother Stavros. I got up at 6 a.m. It was my last day, so I wanted to do it right. And I've been making a habit of getting up early and stepping outside. My breath made giant puffs in the frigid air, but the cold didn't bother me. There's nothing quite like watching the rising sun. I stood there, taking it all in, knowing that I'd be waking up in my own bed tomorrow. I stayed there a little longer than usual. It was as if I was hoping the sun would have an encore. But deep down, I knew the credits had already begun to roll. I briefly looked for Brother Christopher when I got back. I wanted to ask him to call me a car service, but I didn't look too hard because I also wanted to go for one last walk. It was starting to warm up a little bit, so I hit the road. As I was heading back up the hill, Brother Gregory whizzed around the curve in his car. He was coming directly toward me. Fast. We made eye contact as I jumped to the side. He gave me the thumbs up, and then he was quickly out of sight. I stood there in the snowbank, thinking, feeling, knowing, and then it hit me. Remember tomorrow. The voice inside my head was screaming louder than Lenny. It just kept saying the same thing over and over. Remember tomorrow. Remember tomorrow. Remember tomorrow. It's one of the mantras I live by. It's the way I beat up the bully in my head. And in that moment, I knew I had to remember how tomorrow was going to feel if I pulled the ripcord too soon and went home. instantly, everything changed. When you come to a point when you have to make a key decision, remember how that choice will make you feel tomorrow, and the tomorrow after that, and the one after that. You want to drop out of the marathon at mile 18? Okay, that's fine. But remember what it's going to feel like tomorrow when you're left alone to think about it. You want to get drunk and dance on the table at your holiday party? Cool. But remember how it's going to feel tomorrow when you walk into the office. And right there on the side of the road, I was saying to myself, remember what you're going to feel like tomorrow if you quit too soon. When I climbed Mount Washington with my friends, there were times during the hike we all wanted to turn around and call it a day. We were tired, cold, and hungry. As we continued to climb, my friend Nick would say, "It's not an honest hike yet. We have to keep going." What he meant was, we still had more work to do. We had to be honest with ourselves about our effort. Yes, we were on the mountain, but we had not exhausted every ounce in our souls. Only by going past the point when we truly thought we had to stop would it be an honest hike. Complete or incomplete, it has to be honest. I still had more effort to give at the monastery. It wasn't an honest trip yet. Immediately, I felt rejuvenated, knowing I was staying longer to push myself. Making that commitment to myself, where there was no turning back, felt empowering and gave me a second wind. I was all in. On my walk back to my room, I came up with this. You can read The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and listen to 115 Vince Lombardi quotes. You can study Awaken the Giant Within and go to 10 Tony Robbins lectures. However, the only way to truly get better is to close the book, turn off the internet, and go out into the world and stick it out. When you want to quit, get uncomfortable and remember tomorrow. We spend so much of our lives trying to avoid pain. We're all wired to seek comfort, and I love being comfortable. However, the real growth comes when you step outside of that comfort zone and tap into your reserve tank. That's where you see what you're made of, and that's often the place you feel most alive. And that's the other beauty of remember tomorrow. When you truly lay it all out there today, tomorrow is even better. Now, the truth is, learning by doing can be a lot harder than learning online or from a book. When you immerse yourself in something, like I did with Seal and now the monks, there can be times when you want to just pack up and go home. It takes mental toughness and fortitude to complete a new experience. But the experience also needs to be honest, and that's on you. I'm the only person who can say if my stay at the monastery is honest or not. And I know in my heart that it's not. Not yet, but it will be. I've heard that grit is the best indicator of future success. Well, this is becoming the ultimate test of my resilience. It's not like other challenges I've done in my life. Strangely, I like pain, cramps, and a little blood trickling down my shin. It reminds me I'm alive. And sure, a photo of me looking busted up, sweating, and on the verge of a collapse, competing in an endurance event looks pretty gritty hanging on my wall. But I truly like that feeling. I'll tell you what I don't like. Being away from my family, slowing down, left alone to think and reflect all day, doing chores, and not having the comforts of my regular life. So for me to stay here, take some grit. The easy thing would be to go home, to tell myself I stuck it out for a couple of days and pack my bags. But that's what my internal enemy has been singing the last 10 days, and he's got a whole choir backing him up. I signed up for 15 days, and that's what I need to do. If I didn't, I wouldn't be exercising my mental toughness muscle. That'd be like saying it's okay to not finish what I started. One time, I asked Seal if he ever quit something because he was tired. "I don't quit when I'm tired," he said. "I quit when I'm done." Regret? can hurt just as much as physical pain and sometimes last longer. If I had cut my monastery stay short, I know I'd have regretted it long after I left. It's easy to get caught up in the real-time moment and emotions, but that's short-term thinking. When you fast forward and project the future feelings of your decision, you often get clarity and can fight the quit demon. A few years ago, I was doing a 30-mile stand-up paddleboard race around Manhattan. The competition started at Chelsea Piers, headed up past Columbia University, and then crossed over to the East River before ending down by Brooklyn. The currents were incredibly unpredictable and brutally challenging. At times, you could paddle as hard as humanly possible and not move 12 yards. And when you stop to rest, you get pushed 40 feet in the opposite direction. When I showed up, I knew I was in trouble. The competitors looked like Jeff Spicoli on steroids, Hawaiian surfer dudes with super aquatic endurance. They had hydration systems attached to their deck pads. Goos and power bars were duct taped to their boards, and intricate navigation devices were installed on their aerodynamic stand-ups. I had nothing except for the board I purchased online 1 week before the race. It was around the same time I got the idea to enter. When I got to the starting area, I immediately noticed my paddleboard was way shorter than all the other boards, way heavier, and definitely not aerodynamic. Shit. To make my board lighter, I decided to put all of my supplies, water, food, sunscreen, and life jacket, in a canoe my friends Mike and Rob Young rented. I figured I'd be better off having them haul it than carrying it myself in a knapsack for 10 hours. Just stay close to me, I told them. You'll be my crew team. As soon as the race started, 100 paddlers took off and spread across the Hudson in a frenzy. I was headed 30 miles directly into the wind. The currents were super strong. It was hot, like 101 degrees hot. And my board was built for someone shorter than I am and for cruising around a recreational lake. I was fucked. About a quarter mile into the rough sea, I turned around and the Young brothers, my crew team, were nowhere to be seen. I knew at that moment I had to get through the whole race on my own. I wanted to quit. I didn't, though, because of my motto, remember tomorrow. If I quit, I knew I was going to hate the feeling the next day and probably a month from then. I had to gut out 30 miles with no water, food, or sunscreen. I broke the race into many smaller pieces and goals and began to chip away. Just keep chipping away, I repeated to myself. 9 hours later, I finished. Are there times when quitting is the right thing to do? Of course. But quitting just because it's easier is never the right decision. It only takes a minute to quit, but the moment will replay in your mind tomorrow, and the tomorrow after that, and the one after that. Mental toughness is an art form, but like any art form, it takes practice. It's a muscle that has to be exercised consistently. Meditating, praying, quieting the mind, manual labor, and being present are difficult for me, but I know challenging myself is going to pay big dividends. If I quit today, I'll feel lousy about myself tomorrow. The rest of the day felt different, better. I spent a lot of time with Brother Mark. The plan has been for me to rotate my morning chores every day with a different brother. That way, I can get to know each of the monks more intimately and learn what each one does to keep the monastery afloat. I've already worked with Thomas in the dog training center and tending to the dogs at night, with Stavros cleaning the church, with Brother Mark cleaning the dishes, and Brother Gregory preparing the guest house, and I'll be with Brother Ambrose smoking cheese in the next day or so. I'll also be spending time with other monks at the grooming and breeding center. Brother Mark is really friendly. It's like hanging out with an old friend. He leads the prayer services and is in charge of the kitchen. While Josh the cook comes in to prepare several meals, Brother Mark often cooks and cleans on behalf of all as well. Brother Mark looks like he's a 40-year-old tennis pro at a fancy country club with piercing blue eyes, a fit build, and amazingly friendly disposition. As it turns out, Brother Mark is a health nut, so we hit it off right away. He was fascinated by the fact that I've only eaten fruit until noon every day for the last 27 years. "Isn't that too much sugar?" he asked. I explained that the sugar in fruit is one of the most misunderstood concepts as it relates to diet. We spent hours talking about the principles of Harvey Diamond's book, Fit for Life. Fruit is the perfect food if eaten correctly. That means on an empty stomach and eating it with no other food. The less energy you use on digestion, the more energy you have for everything else, I explained. "I'll have to try it," he said. After my time with Brother Mark, Brother Stavros told me to follow him upstairs to the library. The monks have accumulated thousands of books over the last 50 years and have integrated a sophisticated system of logging and managing all the books. In fact, they use the same system that the Library of Congress does to manage their inventory. As we walked through the rows of books, it was fascinating to see the categories and the collection they had amassed. Religious books, business books, diet books, travel books, you name it, they had it. It was a great day. Ironic that my breakthrough came via something I've known all along. My effort has to be honest. Now it feels like I've gotten a second win, but I'm not going to sprint to the finish. That's not very monkish. I'm going to stay focused on being present, think about my breathing, and stride to wherever the finish line might be. And you want to know how intuitive the monks are? I was sitting at breakfast this morning and we were talking about the decision process to become a monk. One brother turned to me and said, "It's really very simple. Decide that you want it more than you're afraid of it." Day 11. Lunch with the nuns. God has not called me to be successful. He has called me to be faithful. Mother Teresa. I watched the sun rise again, but this time it was as if someone had turned on a snow machine. It was coming down from all directions. I quickly retreated to my cell because I wanted to get ready for my big day. I was invited to have lunch with the nuns, something I never thought I'd ever say. I shook and kicked off the snow as I entered my room. I wanted to jot some stuff down, so I started looking through my backpack for a pen. I lost mine overnight somehow. As I rummaged through my bag, I found a piece of paper. I forgot I brought it. Written on it was a morning passage from the Dalai Lama I copied down before I left. My plan was to recite it the first thing every morning. "Every day, think as you wake up. Today, I am fortunate to have woken up. I am alive. I have a precious human life. I am not going to waste it. I'm going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I am going to have kind thoughts towards others. I am not going to get angry or think badly about others. I am going to benefit others as much as I can." At breakfast, Stavros offered to drive me to the nun's house because of the storm. Due to his driving, I wanted to say, "It's okay, I'm going to walk." But when I looked out of my window, I decided to roll the dice and take the ride. It was snowing really hard. He told me he'd meet me in my room about 10 minutes before I was supposed to arrive for my lunch. When he walked in, he was wearing a heavy winter coat that looked like he got it from Sir Edmund Hillary. It must have weighed 200 pounds. I was wearing a light ski jacket. When he saw me, he asked if my coat was a moon jacket. He was mesmerized by the technology of it. He couldn't believe that man was able to make a jacket so lightweight and keep you so warm. "Is that special ordered from NASA?" "No, Stavros. I actually just got it from REI. "What's REI? "Oh, I'm sorry, that's a store that sells outdoor clothing and gear.
And that little parka you're wearing can keep you warm?
Yes, it's a down coat.
It's amazing, just amazing, all these advances.
I thought to myself, I could take a picture on my phone and text it to someone in China, and they'll get the exact image in 0.01 seconds. And he's marveling about a lightweight jacket that keeps me warm? These guys are really behind the curve. The snowstorm smacked me in the face as we walked up to the parking lot. He unlocked the car door and I quickly jumped into an old Subaru. This wasn't the car we drove to the hike, but it had the same vibe. It's just a car. Very basic, like a floor and a motor. That's it. I don't think they opted for any of the upgrades at the dealership. None. It's kind of like riding in a bumper car. Brother Stavros told me to lock the door manually. The front seat was adjusted for a monk who was 5'4", so the bucket was as close to the windshield as the manufacturer allowed. Either that, or one of the monks illegally slid it more toward the dashboard to give a Dwight Howard-sized guest legroom in the back, like 6'11" legroom. I doubt the Charlotte Hornets center was a guest here, so I assume it's just positioned that way for now. Whatever the case, my forehead was touching the windshield. But the monks have been preaching gratitude, and I was grateful for the ride. My knees were in my chest, forcing my balls into my stomach. It wasn't pleasant. I reached back with my right hand and tried to recline back to give myself some relief. And as luck would have it, Stavros chimed in.
Oh, the recliner lever has been jammed for several years.
In that moment, it hit me. There's a children's book here somewhere. The Coat in the Car. Stavros was fascinated by my coat and the modern-day technology of it, and I was fascinated by the simplicity of his car. It made me wonder, are these guys missing out being so far behind the times, or are they actually keeping ahead from an intellectual standpoint by not keeping up? I bet if I lived up here, I'd learn something new from Stavros every day. I stayed jammed against the windshield for the entire ride to the nun's house. I wanted to be on my best behavior because having lunch with nuns is scary. Nuns aren't scary, but the possibilities of offending a nun seem limitless. Sarah once tried to get me to go to etiquette school because of my table manners. I don't think I'm rude or uncouth, but I just see eating as the same thing as the gas station. Fill it up, unleaded. As we approached the nun's house, I wished I'd taken the etiquette course. I wasn't worried I was going to mess up the lunch. We'll call it aware of the potential dangers and comfortably cautious. My views on mealtime have already shifted in my short stay here. I've noticed how special it is at the monastery. We eat at the exact time every single day. That involves sacrifice because the meal and the time together takes precedence over everything else we're doing. There are no excuses to not show up. It never gets pushed back. Mealtime is set in stone, and attendance is mandatory. And all of that is important. It's been said that family dinner is one of the best things you can do for a lasting marriage. I made a mental note to incorporate more family meals when I get back, and some prayer. When the monks say grace, it's a form of gratitude. That small thanks every day is powerful. I want to implement it at home. When I was in my 20s, I wrote 10 handwritten letters every day to thank people, and then I mail them. So many wonderful things have grown from those letters, but most importantly, I could feel gratitude. It flowed daily. And inversely, the time we have at the monastery before the meal is more productive because of it. We know it has to get done by a certain time. So I'm learning to appreciate mealtime much more and trying to get as much out of it as I can. But as important as mealtime is for the monks, you'd think it gets a little boring after 50 years with the same people. But not for them, though. It's a moment of the day to come together, be present, and enjoy. I got dropped off in front of the nun's house. It felt like I was in middle school and my dad just drove me to the movie theater. I waved goodbye as Brother Stavros peeled out of the driveway and fishtailed onto the snow-covered road. I turned around and looked at the house. It was built in